Hi, I'm Ben Trefney, KALW's news director, asking for your support in KALW's spring membership campaign. Go to KALW.org and click Donate Now. We appreciate it.
KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Bayview.
Outer Sunset.
I live in Bernal Heights.
St. Francis Wood.
Coming up, a look at how one Oakland middle school opened up its doors to take in recently immigrated high schoolers.
These are children, even a 16 or 17-year-old. Children deserve our mercy.
Then how those same kids find stable places to live, often by dropping out of school to work.
If you don't have family right here, like, it's very difficult for me because you need to find a job.
And we'll learn what it's like to be an undocumented day laborer in Trump's America.
Jose has been deported four times already and says that being deported is not as big of a concern for him as the wall that President Trump has promised he will build.
Traveling far to make a home in the Bay Area on this special extended version of Cross Currents. Stay with us. For many migrants to the U.S., life is extraordinarily challenging. They can be all alone, fighting complicated legal cases for asylum. They might not speak the language, and they can face the huge responsibility of caring for themselves and providing for their families back home. Now, consider that same scenario for someone who's not yet 18 years old. Across the state of California, Alameda County has taken in the second largest number of unaccompanied minors, kids who've made the treacherous journey across the border by themselves. The struggle to stay in the country has only gotten more difficult. Immigration policies being enforced by the Trump administration make it harder for these children to gain asylum status. Oakland schools have played a central role in making sure these students have what they need. But many of these schools are also at capacity and still figuring out the best way to serve these students. KALW's education reporter Hannah Kingsley Ma has more.
Like a lot of middle schools, Bret Hart's hallways carry with them the faint scent of Axe body spray and the sounds of kids shuffling to class. The school sits in the middle of Oakland, nestled below the big Mormon temple just above the highway. Outside, backpacks dangle from a tall chain-link fence encircling a busy baseball diamond. It's hard not to notice, too, that plastered everywhere are signs reading, "Refugees are welcome here," and "We all belong here and defend each other." They're there to communicate.
Let the outside be the outside, but here at Bret Hart, know you are loved, you are accepted, and we want you to learn, and we're going to do that.
Catherine Wolf oversees the newcomer program at Bret Hart, which for many years has served middle school age students who have been in the country for 3 years or less. Wander through the school and you'll hear multiple languages.
I made a mistake. Yo hago un error. Do you see?
A math class being taught in both English and Spanish.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm Izzeddin Nidat Khalil Ma'ak min Bret Hart Middle
School. Or the Arabic-speaking librarian, Nidat Khalil, calling up parents to make sure they have access to important information. The newcomer population in Oakland School District has been changing a lot, particularly when it comes to high schoolers. 4 years ago, the number of high school-age newcomers in the OUSD was close to 600. In 2017, it's more than doubled. So this year, Bret Hart Middle School created a ninth grade class to take in high school age students. Martin is one of them. For safety reasons, we're not using his real name. He's from El Salvador, has a sweet sideways smile, and crumples paper nervously in his hand when he talks to me. He tells me when he first got here, he was surprised, in the best way, by how respected and welcomed he felt, both by his teachers and by his peers, who are from all over the world. He's been picking up Guatemalan slang from his classmates who speak an indigenous Mayan language, a little Arabic too, from his friends from countries like Afghanistan and Yemen. Their differences often come down to one central question.
Ronaldo or Messi?
Ronaldo.
Ronaldo?
Messi.
Whether they root for Barcelona or Madrid. Bret Hart is well-suited to serve students like Martin. They have experienced newcomer teachers, plus a wellness center next door that provides health and counseling services to students and their families, a crucial element in educating kids who might have experienced horrific violence, interrupted schooling, or sexual trauma in their past. Plus, the school community was just really excited about the prospect. Here again is the head of Bret Hart's newcomer program, Catherine Wolf.
I mean, we have really enjoyed attending to this need. We feel like it is an imperative thing for us to do. And we have a mentality in Oakland, I think, of just, oh, we need that. Okay, let's make it happen. These are children, first and foremost. These are even a 16 or 17 year old. These are children coming to us, and children deserve our mercy. And these are kids who are coming from hard transitions from one country to another, and they are bringing great hope and great dedication with them.
Many of these students are unaccompanied minors from Central America. They've made the unimaginable choice to leave their families behind and make the treacherous journey alone across the border to seek refuge from systemic gang violence and poverty. Lots of them are seeking asylum status through the court system. The school district helps connect them with free lawyers. Wolf says there's a moral imperative in helping these students, who are among some of the most vulnerable in the county and may face far worse conditions if deported.
There are students who for sure would be either required to join a gang or killed if they chose not to. There are students who would be sent to countries where rape or sexual assault or violence would be a part of their daily life. And that kind of fate is not suited for any human. And if we have the power in our hands to choose that fate for a student, we most certainly have a responsibility to help them avoid that.
Martin is super into school, especially math and science. But back in his home country of El Salvador, it was really hard for him to attend.
Donde yo vivía era muy peligroso. Entonces,
where I live, it is very dangerous, he says. That's because once you hit a certain age, the gangs begin to try and recruit you. You have to join or else. Back home, Martin says the only real safe place was church. Now in Oakland, it's also school. He says his goals are to improve his English, finish with good grades, and continue studying.
Mis metas serían de mejorar mi inglés, terminar con buenas calificaciones, y seguir estudiando.
There are a lot of newcomer students like Martin who want to be in school. The question is where to put them. Aside from Bret Hart, there are only four other high school newcomer programs in the district, and they've all been full at different points in the year.
And we had some unused space, and so we were, like, we had the capacity physically to house those kids.
Catherine Wolf says space, which Bret Hart has, is a luxury other high school campuses don't. For instance, Castlemont High in Deep East Oakland grew their newcomer population in the past 2 years by more than 200 students, but they had to improvise classrooms to fit them all in. Bret Hart knew that other schools were filling up, so they opened their doors, and sure enough, they saw a steady flow of students.
Starting in January, we took on about 100 students in a month.
They were serving the growing newcomer population, but teachers found many of their students were having a hard time getting to school. They tended to live in the Fruitvale or in Deep East Oakland, closer to Castlemont. But remember, Castlemont was full, and there's no school bus system in the district. Bret Hart can be a trek from those neighborhoods.
But because of the fact that they're full, they're coming, you know, they're being redirected to us, you know, for 2-3 different buses sometimes just to get to school in the morning.
That's Brian Tang. He's the community school's manager at Bret Hart. Like a lot of teachers here, he grew up in Oakland and knows its streets like the back of his hand. He says there's a lot of intangible knowledge that goes into getting to and from school safely that the newcomers just don't have.
It's super difficult because, you know, they're navigating through different neighborhoods that, you know, the traditional gang wars and different things like that they haven't been privy to. And so now they're knee deep into it and, you know, they have clothes they're not privy to. I can't wear blue on this block or I can't wear red on this block. I'm trekking through these neighborhoods because I have to trek through them in order to get to school.
We get like there's other boy, like he's our friend. Like us and his cousin, we come in the same bus.
Saeed is from Afghanistan. Every day he wakes up at 6 a.m. and takes two buses to get to Bret Hart. He said he was placed there because there were other Afghani students who spoke his language, and those guys helped him navigate the buses when he first got here. Newcomers make easy targets. One of his friends has been jumped before, so they help look out for each other. Saeed remembers what it was first like when he arrived in this country.
I didn't know nothing.
I didn't have no friends, so and I didn't speak English. Like, I was so quiet at the class, and I don't know what to say to teachers or like other people. Like I didn't know. I couldn't even tell them, can you guys help me? So it was so scary and nervous.
Navigating the outside world to get to school can be tough. But really, the thing that educators struggle with the most is the fact that so many newcomer students have to work.
Dejé todo. Mi familia, mis papás y mis hermanos en Guatemala.
These words were written by a student at Bret Hart. To protect her identity, we're not going to use her name or her voice. She says that she left her whole family, her parents and her siblings in Guatemala, to make her American dream a reality. She sends her family money back home and pays rent here.
Mi experiencia en Bret Hart es única. Excelentes maestros, buenos compañeros.
She says that her experience at Bret Hart is that she has wonderful teachers and good friends. But she can only go to school a couple days out of the week because she has to work. There's no one else to support me economically, she writes. Being there only part-time means that it's harder for her to learn English, and it's going to take a lot longer for her to potentially graduate. This is a problem a lot of newcomers face, and the school district knows it. So starting next year, it's going to try a new alternative high school program specifically designed for kids who have to work. The hours are more flexible to accommodate job schedules. Kevin Wolf, Bret Hart's director of newcomer programs, says she's glad the district is scaling up its solutions.
There's not much that we can do as individual school sites to help. Mostly we continue to message to students that their earning potential is significantly increased when they finish school, and try to help them emotionally if they're tired or if they are really balancing a tough schedule between school and work, try to help them with their homework, things like that.
As much as the school is trying to meet newcomers' needs, there have been some setbacks. The district is currently experiencing major budget cuts, and because of it, they've had to let go of one of their part-time staff members, who was a fluent Spanish speaker. She helped students enroll when they first arrived. The principal also told me that the school was considering trying to extend the ninth grade class into a full-fledged high school program. Because of financial restraints, that plan is now on hold. It's also just really, really hard to predict how many students are going to come each year. In the past, OUSD has gotten it wrong. Regardless, educators like Wolf say they're prepared for whatever comes next.
People want their children to do well. Mm-hmm. They want their children to have a better life than they had. And so I still think that we will see many people coming from war-torn countries because they know there's a chance that they can give that to their kids. And as long as they're willing to do that, we are willing to help.
That teenager, the one who left her whole family in Guatemala and is helping support them and herself. She writes, I can't promise that I will be an excellent student at Bret Hart, but I promise to learn as much as I can. I want to keep learning, keep fighting, to move forward with my goals, my dreams. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Kingsley Ma.
Hannah is KLW's education reporter. You can contact her at education@klw.org. And that story was a follow-up to an award-winning documentary KLW produced last year. Coming up, we'll hear what happens when unaccompanied minors have nowhere to live.
So then the kid actually feels really uncomfortable, and they feel like, I'm not welcome here. You know, and then it can get much worse. Scenarios can and do get much worse.
Welcome back to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. We just heard how Oakland schools are trying to help settle young immigrants who come to this country alone. But school is only possible when an adult is taking care of the basic needs, like most expensively in the Bay Area, housing. For a lot of young migrants, maintaining a stable place to live can be a challenge. When they first cross the border, they're detained by immigration officials who release them only if a family member or sponsor agrees to take them in. And often that sponsor is someone they've never met, a distant relative or a family friend. The living arrangement doesn't always last. KLW's housing reporter Liza Veal wanted to know what happens next.
...18-year-old Milton knows all the songs on the radio, even if he can't pronounce all the words in English. I'm riding along with Milton and Christian Ruiz, Milton's soccer coach and friend and mentor in a million ways. We're headed up to the Berkeley Hills, just for the view. Christian's just a few years older than Milton, and he's been showing him around the Bay Area since Milton first arrived, a little over a year ago. Milton is captain of the soccer team, but he also has a reputation for being kind of a class clown. Christian says he's always making a fool out of himself, so the people he's with have fun. As soon as we're out of the car, Milton's running ahead with the soccer ball. Oakland and Berkeley are baking in the hot haze below us. I pant climbing up a slope while Milton dribbles the ball in circles around me, doing tricks.
He doesn't get tired.
Before the U.S., Milton's home was Guatemala. His mom has medical bills, and in his village, he says there was no way to scrape up the money to pay them. So he came here to work, like so many young migrants. At the top of the hill, Milton squints out at the Oakland neighborhood, Fruitvale, where he's bounced around for most of his time in the Bay Area. And he points out the tree-lined streets of Elmwood, where he's just moved in.
Yeah.
Is that Lake Mayor?
Milton worked full-time when he first came to this country, to Florida. He was 15 years old, bouncing around different relatives' and friends' houses. For a while, here in Oakland, his living situation was stable enough that he enrolled in school. But then, the house he was staying at got too crowded, 13 people in two rooms. So he started sleeping on the floor at a friend's place. Milton says Christian dropped him off once after practice, and when he saw the place, he got upset.
He's going to look the place and he said that. Bro, it's hella bad.
Why didn't you tell me? Christian asked him. He wanted Milton to move out of there, but Milton told him he couldn't afford that unless he dropped out of school to work full time.
He was having a bit of a breakdown and freaking out.
I find a way, like, because Christian, he's a good people, and I told him what happened with me, and he say, I can help you.
Remember, Christian's only 21, but together they tried to figure out Milton's options. Young migrants that come here alone often have unstable housing. Yet, it's a lot harder for them to get help than kids who are citizens. If you're born in this country and the adults in your life aren't properly housing you, you may go into foster care. But kids like Milton, who don't have green cards, aren't eligible. There's only one shelter in Oakland that takes minors, and they say the number of migrant children coming to them has been growing. They estimate they've taken in 35 in the last 4 months. But that's for a temporary stay. There's also only one long-term housing support program in the Bay Area for unaccompanied minors, and they can't help you unless you've already won asylum status. Fortunately, Milton had. This was his one shot for getting stable housing without giving up the life he'd made here. But he was turning 18 soon, at which point he'd be disqualified from help. Christian says the process was moving slowly and Milton was losing hope.
He would text me or call me in the moments. Sometimes I could feel like he was about to cry and would like hang up. I remember one conversation we had and he would just text me back like, sorry, I just can't talk, but like this is happening. So it was just like really hard moments where there was no one else.
On the phone, Milton's mother was telling him to stay in school, but to him, the whole reason he was here was to help her with money. Then, 4 days before his 18th birthday, he got into the long-term housing program he applied to. He moved into the spare bedroom of a man who lives alone in Berkeley. The man doesn't have custody, but he does have to be vetted by the program, which pays the rent.
His house is classic wood shingle Berkeley on a block full of near mansions and immaculate gardens.
The house is big. Then you got kitchen and you got bed. You got big bed and a big room. I'm excited.
Milton beat the odds. With rent covered, he gets to keep being a teenager. His cousins came a few years before, and they weren't as lucky.
They working. They're not going to school because they need to help the families or they need work.
Milton works to send money back to Guatemala too, but he can do that after school and on the weekends. He says his cousins, they've lived isolated lives ever since they came to this country. They moved in with a distant relative that could only house them long enough for them to find work and move out.
They live lonely. Then nobody told they, like, the school's good. You need to go into school. Nobody.
Nobody looking after them. Immigration enforcement releases young migrants into the custody of adults, but they rarely check back up on them. If they did, they'd find that many end up fending for themselves. Milton's cousins haven't learned English, which is something he gets on them for.
They don't understand English, and then when they go into the, like, to the store, then they, like, say to the, how much? Then they tell me, what she say? Then I say, I don't know, bro. Then I say, she say you need to pay $100. Yeah. And they say, what? They only buy a juice?
All of Milton's soccer teammates are new to this country. It's a league for recent immigrants. I ask him how many he thinks are in a position like he was, the kind of living situation that's so bad they might have to drop out of school in order to scrape up the money to live somewhere else. He and Christian think together.
See, I think four.
They count four other kids out of 15 or 20. But what's harder to measure are the housing needs of the young people who aren't in school, who aren't connected to adults like Christian. We can only guess at that population.
The missing part is the size of the problem.
Sergio Medina has worked in child refugee services for 18 years. In the past, he ran a shelter in the East Bay, and now he runs an organization called RISE, Refugee and Immigrant Services.
We just don't know how many undocumented immigrant kids that are alone.
I'm talking to him because the shelter that takes in minors right now, they didn't want to expose themselves. They said it was unwise to be identified with undocumented services, given the politics of federal funding right now. So she referred me to Medina. Medina has heard stories like Milton's countless times. He says so many of the living arrangements between unaccompanied kids and their sponsors are like ticking time bombs.
Resentment in the family kind of builds. And you're like, oh, well, we're helping out this kid. What about our children? You're helping your third cousin twice removed. So then the kid actually feels really uncomfortable, and they feel like, I'm not welcome here. You know, and then it can get much worse. Scenarios can and do get much worse.
When a kid is taken in by a sponsor that's not close family, there are often strings attached. The deal can easily verge on exploitation. This wasn't Milton's experience, but Medina says there are adult sponsors out there who take advantage of the situation. It's part of the broad spectrum that is child trafficking. Medina's met a lot of young migrants that stay with exploitative sponsors because they have no other option.
So worked with two girls. They were over 18, living with this man, unrelated to them. He was forcing them to have sex in exchange for rent and food.
He says he tried to persuade them to come to the shelter and apply for transitional housing. One of them chose to stay in the man's house. The other escaped on her own. Medina says for kids who do leave,
they leave into kind of the unknown. Yeah. They're like, I have to leave the only place that I have and figure out where the hell I'm going to go. We can't underestimate how difficult that decision is to make.
Every young person that's made it to this country on their own has already made at least one impossibly difficult decision: to leave home in the first place. As for 18-year-old Milton, he says it's been a lot harder here than he pictured.
If you don't have family right here, like, it's very difficult to leave because you need to find a job. You need to pay a rent, phone, food, everything.
In the really lonely moments, he says he regrets coming here.
Sometimes Yeah, because I miss my family. Then when I call my mom, she say, when you back to Guatemala? And I say, tomorrow. Then she say, what? Yeah.
Why does she ask you that?
Because she's feel bad and she's sick and she need money. Then that's why I'm working.
And that's why he came here. In a way, to keep his family from falling apart. But with his asylum status, he can't go back. They may never be together again. But for him and the many unaccompanied migrant youth living here, it's the only way forward. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
Liza Veal is KLW's housing reporter. If you've got a story you want her to look into, email her at housing@klw.org. Coming up, we'll hear from undocumented workers who are here not just to make a living, but for their own safety.
Queremos ir, pero nos quieren matar allá porque hay muchos delincuencia.
He tells me we want to go home, but we're here out of necessity for our children, our wives, our family.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. You've probably seen them, groups of men looking for work, standing in front of Home Depot or waiting on corners of busy avenues. These men are day laborers looking for short-term work, ranging from gardening to painting. On any given day, there are almost 120,000 day laborers looking for work here in the U.S., and about 40% of them are in California. Hiring day laborers informally is not illegal, but those work contracts can get muddy quickly, especially if the worker is an undocumented immigrant. A much-cited 2004 national study found 80% of California's day laborers are undocumented. Looking for this kind of work has been even riskier under President Trump, who's promised to triple the number of immigration agents and remove all undocumented immigrants from the U.S. KALW's Josiah Luis Alderete went to one of those corners to learn what life is like as a day laborer today. And a note, we've changed the names of some of the people in this story for their protection.
Roberto is pointing at a small battered car that just pulled into the shopping center parking lot where we're standing. A group of men in paint-splattered jeans and boots walk towards it. Roberto tells me the car is here to pick up some workers. It's early, around 7:45 a.m., but there are already a dozen men standing around the lot and plenty of traffic on the street. Sometimes they pick up one or two, he says, and then they're gone, and the rest of us are waiting. Roberto and I watch as a few men lean their heads in to speak with the driver, then eventually hop in the car, and it drives off. This is how it usually goes when people come here to pick up day laborers at the corner of Bellum and the off-ramp of 580, right in front of the Marin Square shopping center in San Rafael. Roberto tells me this is a good spot because potential employers come here from all over the Bay Area, Point Reyes, Petaluma, Richmond, to look for workers. I grew up here in the Canal District of San Rafael. Mi mamá's Mexican restaurant was only a few blocks away from this corner. Back in the 70s, I used to go to see movies at the drive-in that stood here, before it was a shopping center and pickup spot. Roberto tells me he arrived in California 16 years ago from Guatemala.
Yo estoy bien en Guatemala. Yo tengo un buen negocio en Guatemala. Yo soy un comerciante en Guatemala. Yo compro papa.
Roberto had a good business back home, exporting potatoes. But then, he says, he was attacked and robbed by a gang, who told him if he didn't pay them 200,000 quetzals, which is almost $28,000, they'd kill him. So he left.
Queremos ir, pero nos quieren matar allá porque hay muchos delincuencia.
He tells me we want to go home, but we're here out of necessity for our children, our wives, our family. On any given day, you'll see as many as 40 or 50 men scattered around the perimeter of this shopping center. Fabio, also not his real name, is another one of these men looking for work. though he hasn't been around as long as Roberto.
De Guatemala.
De Guatemala, de Guatemala. ¿Y cuánto tiempo tiene aquí?
5 años.
Fabio's also from Guatemala, and he's been here 5 years. He says he came to the States because of the poverty and lack of opportunity back home. He doesn't have much formal education and doesn't write very well, so it's easier to do jobs where he doesn't have to read or sign paperwork.
Ya me ha pasado a mí aquí, me han discriminado mucho, que no solo por una firma.
He says employers here have discriminated against him just because of his signature, just because he can't sign his name right. Even so, Fabio can make better money here in the States than back home. He says he can make up to $40 an hour for carpentry work, for example. That's unusual. The national average for day laborers is $11 an hour. Most workers can only find employment a few days a week, so income levels can vary from month to month. A laborer in California can make $1,500 in a good month, but during slow months, that number drops to as low as $500. Most of these men won't make more than $15,000 a year.
O con su necesidad, no, porque hay unos que acaban de venir, se van a $10 la hora.
Fabio tells me that the newer guys here will sometimes only ask for $10 an hour. Andy says employers will try and squeeze as much out of you as they can.
Y lo exprimen a uno hasta donde ellos pueden.
While waiting for work, Fabio, Roberto, and the other day laborers can spend hours standing here on the corner without a meal. Sometimes when I was a kid, mi mamá and I would come out here and hand out burros to the men so they could have breakfast.
Sí, son buenos, como digo, hay gente racista y hay gente bueno, hay gente...
Fabio tells me that there's racist people and there are good people. The good ones, he says, give you water and feed you. But there are others that just throw you in the back of the car. He says sometimes Americans will drive by and blare their horns just to scare the workers.
Hay unos americanos vienen y te hacen el timón por querer asustarte.
Working conditions for laborers can also be really tough. Almost half of the day laborers in the country have reported at least one instance of wage theft. And 75% of the laborers in California said that they felt their jobs were dangerous. About a decade ago, the city of San Rafael decided to try and formalize the hiring process by piloting an online hiring hall and a day labor opportunity center, where workers could have access to computers, restrooms, and English or vocational training classes. Similar programs exist in other Bay Area cities. But after 2 years, the sponsors of San Rafael's program decided to discontinue it. And so for now, corners like this one are the only option for workers in the area. There's a security guard here at the shopping center that treats the day laborers well, Fabio tells me. Technically, the workers are not allowed to hang out on the property, nor are they allowed to negotiate with potential employers there. That's why they all stand around the perimeter.
Lo dejan ahí que hacen el trato, ¿no?, para ir a trabajar.
Fabio says this guard will let them make deals and doesn't harass them. I talked to the guard myself. He preferred not to share his name.
Yeah, I talked to some most of the time. They're going to tell you everything, what is going on here, your personal life.
The guard just immigrated here himself 8 months ago from Ethiopia. He tells me it took 3 tedious years to get a green card and join his wife. He says he believes that all immigrants should have a chance here in the U.S., but he thinks they should try to go through the system legally.
I support that process. Someone who want to come here in America should pass this process. I think that's good.
Documented or not, the workers tell me they do deserve to be here. Without the Latinos, the U.S. would fall because we do all the work, says Jose. He's the only one who gave us his real name. Jose is also from Guatemala, and he's been working here for 23 years. He says he has a right to be here because he's worked here for so long.
Yo me siento bien en este país. Con el tiempo que yo le he trabajado en este país, yo me siento que también tengo derecho a estar aquí.
Jose has been deported 4 times already, and says that being deported is not as big of a concern for him as the wall that President Trump has promised he will build. He tells me he's worried, but he'll wait and see what happens.
Salimos de este lugar con miedo a ver qué pasa si nos corren o pasa alguna, viene el ICE aquí y nos agarra, ya nos fuimos.
Fabio says he's also worried. Maybe they'll be run off, Or maybe ICE will pass by, grab them, and they'll be gone. There were immigration raids years ago. I remember seeing one through the window of mi mamá's restaurant in the mid-90s. This cop pulled over a car, and almost immediately a white van came up behind them. The cop pushed the Latino driver and passengers into the back, and the van drove off. The whole thing happened in a matter of minutes. Today, there are constant rumors circling around the Canal District in San Rafael about imminent ICE raids. I hear about them often from friends who live in the neighborhood. For now, they're just rumors. They still come out every day to see what happens, Jose says of the day laborers. They come every day to this corner, and corners all around the Bay Area. Cesar Chavez and Harrison in San Francisco, High Street and San Leandro Avenue in Oakland, the Home Depot in San Jose, waiting to see what will happen. On a corner in San Rafael, yo soy Josiah Luis Alderete for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Josiah. Nina Gensler-Debs co-produced that story. Coming up, another population affected by deportation, African and Caribbean immigrants.
It was the Ebola outbreak that impacted these three countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. But now the department is saying that the Ebola outbreak is no longer an issue, therefore it's safe for these folks to go back home.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. When you think about immigration and deportation in the U.S., one population may not immediately come to mind: Black immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean. It's a growing population, estimated at between 2 and 4 million people, and they too have been facing deportation. The Center for American Progress estimates 400,000 undocumented Africans in the U.S., and many say they're being ignored in a time of travel bans and tough immigration policy. BAJI, or the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, is working to bring Black immigrant issues to the forefront. But it hasn't been easy to get support. Bay Area coordinator Devante Jackson joined me in studio to tell me why. First, I asked him what issues they're following right now.
There's temporary protected status that is expiring for Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
What is temporary protective status?
It's a lawful status given to people from certain countries, and the Department of Homeland Security chooses which countries have temporary protected status.
Based on, like, what's going on in their countries?
And so it was the Ebola outbreak that impacted these three countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. But now the department is saying that the Ebola outbreak is no longer an issue. Therefore, it's safe for these folks to go back home.
Therefore, go back home?
Right.
Like ending the program.
So ending temporary protected status. So what that means is that there's other lawful status that people can obtain. But if their only lawful status is temporary protected status right now, then they'll become undocumented.
BAJI issued a report and a news release that the 60-day notification deadline for temporary protective status redesignation is approaching May 23rd for Haitian nationals, for people from Haiti. What does that mean? That's coming up.
So, So temporary protective status was established for Haitians during the earthquake in 2010. And so similar to the Ebola outbreak scenario, the Department of Homeland Security is now saying that it is safe for Haitians to go back to Haiti, and they're prioritizing their removal. And so this is at the same time there's a bunch of political struggle happening in Haiti, as well as Hurricane Matthew, and there's been a cholera outbreak. So by no means is it safe for folks to go back to Haiti in this moment.
And in your release, it says if TPS redesignation of Haiti is not granted, as many as 50,000 Haitians living across the U.S. will be stripped of work authorization and will be prioritized for ICE removal.
Right. And so we've been doing a lot of advocacy around getting DHS to redesignate TPS for these impacted countries. But, you know, it's a Trump administration, so it's going to take a lot of power and a lot of resistance to get them to change their agenda.
Do you feel your work is harder now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have to definitely dig deeper and get more people involved and really create models for community defense, because we're in the moment right now where we need to protect our neighbors, where we need to protect our families, our community. And that's really what Baji is trying to do, is build models so we can do deportation defense, so that we can help keep as many as our folks as possible here with their families.
So your organization uniquely brings together the concerns of Black immigrants and Black immigrant communities, but also African Americans who are not immigrants. And so what are some of your biggest challenges?
I think building true solidarity is actually really hard and challenging work. Because a lot of people will lift up the fact that there's Black immigrant communities who treat African American communities as if they're thugs, gangsters, all of these things that are popular opinion about African Americans in the U.S., right? A lot of Black immigrants come in holding these kind of sentiments. And we acknowledge those feelings, acknowledge that hurt, that pain, and acknowledge the division that is very real. And what we try to really do is get people to not look at the individual, acknowledge individual experience and individual hurt, but really look at the institution, the systemic issues that are facing our communities.
And they relate in that way? Like, that's how you...
Oftentimes, we do. For example, I'm African American, too, and oftentimes I lift up my experience. So my family came from Louisiana to settle in Oakland, also fleeing, you know, racialized violence from the South, educational opportunities. And when we tease out those stories, we see that there's actually very similarities to why people are moving, why people are migrating. And then we really talk about the policies that are forcing people to migrate. We talk about neoliberal policies that devastated, like, the rice economy in Haiti and flooded it with, you know, our rice and undermined their local economy, right? And the devastation and the poverty that they were experiencing caused a lot of migration, caused a lot of Haitians to seek jobs in, like, Brazil and things. There's thousands of Haitians who are actually coming from Brazil to the U.S.-Mexico border because of policies like this rice policy that flooded their markets. And so once we talk about some of these things, we see that the system is really the boot on our neck. We're stronger together in all of our diverse beauty. It's powerful.